Well, thank you very much, Sabina, for the introduction. It's really a pleasure to be here. I wanted to comment on the twin theory from Sabina. Usually it works the other way around. She has the ideas, and I just kind of wait to receive them. At least that's my perspective. Okay, so before I forget, I just want to mention a few names here. These are people that have helped me, if I can use this pointer correctly, along the way in this project. I've started working on Mercury maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and now I've kind of continued working on Mercury, doing stuff that I never thought I would be doing. So it's all new work. In some ways, all the results that I will be presenting are preliminaries. I'm not sure if I'm even ready to, present all this, but we'll go ahead and see this. So these collaborators, Attilio Rivoldini, Tim Valnoust, and Marie Isabeau are working at the Royal Observatory of Belgium. Okay, so today I'm going to talk about Mercury, and it's interesting time to work on Mercury because we do have a planetary satellite, or a satellite called MESSENGER, which is currently in orbit around Mercury. This is an artist's rendition of this satellite approaching Mercury. So it was launched in 2004, entered orbit essentially 2 years ago. So it's still in orbit. So here's some of the stats. So the closest point in the orbit is about 200 kilometers on top of the surface. And now the slides are just going by themselves. Okay, so one of the nice things we get when we have a satellite is we get spectacular images. All right, so this is kind of real color image of Mercury, and you can see it's sort of this gray surface. It's very much like the moon, right? There's impact craters, some of these structures here, and what's going on? I need to stop doing that. Okay. All right, and more spectacular image here. This is a close-up of the surface where we can see these craters again. And it's kind of this basaltic gray surface. But on top of images, we also get great data. This is the topography viewed from the North Pole. So things that are in red are 2 kilometers higher than the mean radius of Mercury, things in blue about 2 kilometers lower. And so clearly some things are related to impact structure, but there are also broad variations in topography, which are related to either past sort of tectonic processes or subsidence related to underlying mantle convection. But essentially now we have great data for that. We also have data on the gravity field. Okay, so on this top image here, I'm showing the so-called free air gravity anomaly. So the units here are in milligals. So and these anomalies amplitude are about the same as those that we see for Earth. Okay, so roughly speaking, they're about 10,000 times smaller than the radial component of gravity. So we see more structure on the northern hemisphere than the southern hemisphere, but that's only partly because the satellite goes closer to the surface in the northern part of the planet, and so that's just a resolution issue. It's not sort of a different dynamics or anything. On the bottom slide, the bottom part of the slide here, I'm showing the geoids. So this is the topography in meters, so from plus to minus 100 meters or so, of the surface where the gravitational potential is constant. Okay, so if there was an ocean on top of Mercury, this would be the shape of the surface of the ocean. And so we can see these kind of blobs and so on. And so the geoid gives us sort of the shape of the planet in terms of its gravity field. Okay, and typically we express those in terms of these coefficients. So this guy here called J2 is a coefficient which expresses the degree by which the planet is elliptical, going from pole to the equator. Okay, and it's related to the moments of inertia of the planet. So C is the polar moment of inertia, and A and B are the two equatorial moments of inertia. M here is the mass of the planet, and R the radius. And so J2 being positive means that the planet is slightly elliptical, so bulging at the equator, which works with the fact that, it's because of the rotation of Mercury. It's a slow rotation, but there's still a bulging effect. But there's also an ellipticity along the equator, which is essentially captured by this coefficient called C22, which is also related to moments of inertia. In this case, it's just the difference between the two equatorial moments of inertia. Okay, so Messenger has given us really good numbers on these two quantities. Now the errors are of the level of 1%. Okay, so we know the gravity field pretty well. And we're going to use this further on to constrain the interior of the planet. Okay, so how does Mercury differ to Earth? So here's on the left, we have the Earth. So, you know, the crust here, there's an oceanic part of the crust, there's a continental part. And then we have the mantle, so the upper mantle or the asthenosphere. And then about halfway down, we get to the core. So the core, there's a liquid bit, mostly liquid iron, with some about 10% weight of light elements. And then the central bit here is the solid inner core, which is really mostly solid iron. Here's Mercury's internal structure, okay? First of all, Mercury is much smaller, so here's the relative size. So Earth, you know, 6,000 kilometers in radius, but Mercury is only 2440. And then the core of Mercury really takes up the whole planet. 80% of the planet is core. So it's a completely different planet for that. So there's still a mantle on top of it, but then, you know, we have a liquid core, and really, we suspect that there is a solid inner core, but we don't know how big it is, okay? So that's partly one of the questions that I'm going to try to answer here today. Okay, so one of the things that, if you look at a planet like Mercury, it has a very thin mantle. So in terms of thermal evolution of a planet, you know, you have heat which is trapped by, you know, primordial heat from the impact that has created the planet. And that, over time, that heat is trying to escape the planet. So, and it does so by going through convection. But really, if you think of a planet like this, Mercury has a very thin mantle, so you suspect that it's going to be easy to get rid of a lot of heat. So in some ways, we suspect that the whole of the core should have a very low temperature, and therefore that it should be all solidified by now. But it's not the case. We have good evidence that part of Mercury's core is liquid, and I'll show you how we deduce that. So let's talk about mantle convection. This is the situation for Earth where we have plate tectonics. So parts of the crust here, the oceanic crust, is subducting. It's cold, it's participating in convection. It takes cold stuff, bringing it down, and vice versa. There's hot stuff coming up. You create new oceanic plate. There's a lot of heat flow coming out. So essentially, the fact that we have plate tectonics on Earth allows the mantle to have a very vigorous mantle convection. You can take a lot of heat out of the core and release it. Okay? I mean, we don't have any evidence at the surface of Mercury of anything like plate tectonics, right? And so if there is mantle convection in Mercury, it's more likely going under the regime, the so-called stagnant lid convection, where convection may occur underneath, but on top here, this is just kind of a thermal layer, which is very stable. And so it's much harder to get heat out of a system like this than a system like this, more appropriate for the Earth. Okay, so then we need to worry about or wonder what's the effect of either high heat flux out of the core or low heat flux out of core going to have onto the dynamics of the fluid core. So here's a cartoon where I'm showing temperature on this axis and depth or pressure on this axis. So here we have the mantle, the core mantle boundary. This is not the cosmic background. The fluid core, it's important to know your audience, my mother always says. So this is the center of the planet. Okay, and what I'm showing here is a situation where we have a high heat flux out of the core. The red curve represents the adiabatic temperature in the core. So the core is vigorously convecting. So this is sort of the temperature, the mean temperature of the core. I need to find a way to stop this automatic switching of the slides here. I don't know how to do this. Let me just try to restart this. No, it's all fine. Okay, let's give this a try. So here in blue, I have the liquidus, okay? So this is the temperature below which material will start to solidify. So, you know, in the core of the planet, we have mixture of iron, which is fluid, and some light elements. when the curve here, the red curve, is going to cross at some point the adiabat, then we're going to start precipitating solid material, and that's going to be dominantly just the solid part of iron releasing light element on the way. Okay, so if you cool down the planet with a high heat flux, this is a situation which is appropriate for the Earth. You're first going to cross the liquidus close to the center or at the center. So when you do this here, everything below this boundary will be solid. Okay, so you form a solid inner core. This is the inner core boundary. Now, at this point, two things occur. As the planet still cools, you have a growth of the inner core. In other words, the front where we have crystallization migrates further outward. Two things happen in this process. Not only the freezing of the material releases some latent heat, so that's good because that can participate in convection and help to generate a magnetic field. But you also have a release of light element because preferentially it's the iron part of the solid which gets incorporated into the inner core. Okay? And so if you release some light element compared to the average mixture here, then it's lighter, it's buoyant, and it wants to rise. So that also participates in convection. Okay? So by growing an inner core, we have two additional sources of energy which can sustain a magnetic field. So that's very good. But if you are in a planet where you have a low heat flux at the core mantle boundary, then what's going to happen is that you need to adjust the temperature gradient coming out of the core. And if you need a much lower temperature gradient, then you're going to be in a situation where the temperature is going to be our so-called subadiabatic. Okay? So in other words, here, you still have a sort of a decrease of temperature as a function of radius. But you know, if you take away the effect of pressure, in a sense, this is like having a very warm part of the core versus a very cold part of the core. In other words, this is a stable stratification system. Okay? So if you take a parcel of material, you know, which is kind of at a cold temperature, you put it higher, it's colder than the surrounding, it's denser, it sinks again. Okay? So you don't get convection in this regime. But as you cool temperature, then you do. Let's put that back up again. So as this temperature goes down, then eventually you do again cross the liquidus here. So then you create convection in this region here, and by growing an inner core, you release some light element and latent heat, which participates into convection. And this is a crucial bit here because you need that in order to keep the temperature at a temperature gradient which is larger than the adiabatic gradient. Because thermally alone, the cooling here is not able to sustain generation of the magnetic field. It's not able to sustain convection because you know your cooling rate essentially produces a stable temperature gradient. So you need an additional source of energy. Okay? So if we have low heat flux coming out of Mercury, then it's likely that there's a situation where we have kind of a stable layer at the top of the core. Okay, things can get more complicated. This is a diagram showing the liquidus in a mixture of iron and iron sulfur. Okay, the color here represents the position of the liquidus as a function of how much sulfur we have in the mixture. Okay, so here we have pressure, temperature, so these pressures are corresponding to the core mantle boundary of Mercury and the center. Okay. And so for combination of sulfur and iron, what's happening is that the shape of these curves are bizarre enough that it may be that the first place where when we drop temperature upon cooling, the first place where we cross the liquidus is not at the center, but it may be at the core mantle boundary or even somewhere in the middle here. Okay? So that's one thing. The second thing is, by adding sulfur to the core, you also drop the melting temperature. So in other words, for the same temperature, you're more likely to have a fluid core rather than a solid core. Okay? So these two elements are important. So we need to wonder what's going to happen if you, for example, first cross the liquidus at the core mantle boundary. Okay, so this is a situation of high heat flux. So let's suppose we drop the temperature by cooling. Now, everywhere here, we're below the liquidus, so we're going to form solid. Again, we're going to form a solid which is predominantly solid iron. So we're going to create snow, okay, and also release of sulfur, light element. Now, this snow is going to sink. Eventually, in this region, it's likely going to dissolve again in the solution. So this is kind of a snow zone here. We still have convection here. But as this process continues, we get, in this region, an enrichment of sulfur, and in this region, an enrichment of iron, okay? So now, if this region has more sulfur, then with higher sulfur, the liquidus will drop. Here, with less sulfur and more iron, the liquidus will go up. So eventually, what will happen is this process will continue until the adiabat and the liquidus are coincident. Okay? And then upon further cooling, you'll migrate this boundary here all the way to the center until this is the case everywhere in the core. And so now you have kind of snow forming everywhere in the whole of the core. All right, and in this process, once you get to that, upon further cooling, then you can have an inner core growth, okay? Because then, you know, at some point, the snow will make it all the way to the middle, and then it won't dissolve again, and so then you can just accumulate an inner core. But there's also a, you'll also form a gradient in sulfur. In other words, you know, the constant release of light element will create this sort of, this sort of stratification in sulfur concentration. Okay, let me go back. All right, and then, you know, it's very interesting because then this is stable against convection in the sense that if you take a parcel of material here, you move it here, it's less buoyant than, or you know, it's heavier, so it should sink back. But the release of sulfur should create some fingering convection, so you can still have convection going. Okay. All right, so then in the situation of a lower heat flux and then reducing the adiabat, I really have, I'm really not competent enough to play with this computer here, clearly, but okay, let's try to do that again. So in a situation where we have, yeah, stay there. Okay, hopefully this is gonna work. Okay, in a situation where you know, we do have a low heat flux and a sub-adiabatic region, then you know, in this hypothetical scenario, we would first cross the liquidus here, so we would form a snow layer, but again, this process will enrich sulfur here, enrich iron here, and eventually we will get into a situation where we do have a coincident adiabat and liquidus and then inner core growth. Okay, so all of these ideas, essentially, they relate to the magnetic field of the planet, okay? The exact structure and dynamics of convection in the core are responsible for the magnetic field that we see at the surface of Mercury. So, you know, here's a comparison between the magnetic field of the Earth and magnetic field of Mercury. So the surface of the Earth, we have a field which is dominantly dipolar, you know, a bit of a tilt and so on. It's more complicated when you go to the source of the dynamo region at the top of the core. But here's in comparison the surface field of Mercury. Okay, so first thing, there's a big difference in scale here. This is 80 microtesla versus 0.8. Okay, so the field strength here is about 1% of that of Earth. So that's one thing. Second thing here is that the field is really axisymmetric. There's not a lot of structure in longitude. And then on top of that, it seems to be offset. It's hard to see on this color scale, but the location of the magnetic equator does not coincide with the planetary equator. It's a bit further up. So it's as if you've taken the dipole and moved it up. So essentially, whatever is happening in convection in the core, you must be able to explain this type of magnetic field. Okay, so a field of low strength will have consequence in terms of the magnetosphere. So this is the magnetosphere of the Earth here. Magnetosphere is enormous. But for the magnetic field or the magnetosphere of Mercury, it's really close to the planet. And so the field near the surface of Mercury is really a mixture of the internal field and effects from the solar wind and currents created in the magnetosphere. So it's much more complicated and so on. Okay, now this idea that the field strength at Mercury's surface is weak has been known for years, and people have tried to come up with explanations for why that could be so. So here's an idea by your very own Sabine, and the idea was that, well, maybe it's if you have a very thin shell, so this is kind of an Earth-like dynamo with a thick shell, but here this is a thin shell geometry, then it may be possible to explain why the field would have such a low strength. So that's one idea. Here's another idea. And that sort of exploits the fact that if the top of the core is thermally stratified, then you should have convection really in the inner part here, close to the inner core boundary. And in this case, you get a dynamo which produces a very complex or complicated picture inside the planet. But then this layer here acts as an electrical screening effect. And so it filters out all the short length scale and rapid time scale dynamics such that at the planetary surface, you only see kind of the large scale dipole field. And in this particular case, it's a bit more complex. But I'll show you later examples where, you know, this process leads to a field which is very axis symmetric. So that's another idea. Here's another one, again, by one of your very own Ryan Valim. And this is appealing to the idea of snow falling. And so here in this case, you have kind of two dynamo source region. And again, right, this is a mechanism which can produce a radial field at the surface of approximately the correct amplitude. So that could be an idea for Mercury's field. One last one. This one appeals to the fact that since Mercury's field is not very strong, then there's going to be interaction with the magnetosphere. And in this case, that essentially participates in terms of a feedback effect with the dynamo. And without going into the details of this, you know, in terms of field strength, this would be correct. Although one prediction of this model is that you get essentially the odd harmonics of the field which dominate the spectrum. And in terms of the picture that we see today of Mercury, the quadrupole term here is actually much higher. So that doesn't seem to be a good prediction. Okay, so here's, you know, and there are more suggestions out there, but here we have four ideas for the generation of the magnetic field. So which of these is correct or which combination is correct? In some ways, to answer this, it'd be good to have some structure of the interior of the planet, right? If we knew that the inner core was small, well, that wouldn't work, right? If we knew that we don't have any thermal layer, well, that wouldn't work, and so on. So we need to find a way to build models of the interior structure of the planet. And to do so, I'm going to use gravity and rotation observations. Okay, so before we do this, we need to look into the orbital dynamics of Mercury. Mercury is in so-called Cassini 1 state, where the rotation axis, the axis of the perpendicular to the orbital plane, and the axis perpendicular to the plane around which the orbital plane processes are all coplanar. And this angle here, the obliquity, is actually related to the gravity field or the moments of inertia of the planet, and also this quantity, C over mr squared, so that's still the polar moment of inertia. So that kind of represents the way the mass is distributed inside the planet. Okay, so for a planet of uniform density, this would be 0.4. For Earth, we have 0.33 something. So if we can measure this, we would have essentially a measure of this quantity. Okay, so that would be a constraint on the interior structure of the planet. We also have a constraint coming from the libration. So this is kind of a top view of the orbit of Mercury around the sun. And the dot here on the surface represents kind of a position on Mercury's surface where the elliptical shape of the planet has been grossly exaggerated. Okay. Now, Mercury is trapped into this kind of funny 3-2 spin orbit resonance, in which it rotates around the sun three times, or two times for each time it rotates around itself, three times for each due rotation around the sun. Okay? And as a result of this, then as the planet proceeds in its orbit, then at some point, then its long axis of moment of inertia is no longer aligned with the sun direction, and so there's going to be a torque. In this case, that's going to try to slow down the planet, but here it's going to try to speed up the planet. So on top of the rotation of Mercury, we also have these oscillations, which are called librations. And the amplitude of these librations depend on whether the planet is fully rigid or whether it's only the outer shell that ridges. If it's only the outer shell, then the amplitude of these librations will be much larger. Okay? So, using these ideas, we can actually, or somebody, Stan Peale, has devised an idea to determine whether Mercury has a fluid core. Okay? His idea was that, well, we can just write Cm over C, and here, this is just math, we've not done anything, this B minus A, mR squared, mR squared. Okay? But now, if we have a measure of the obliquity, we have a value of this. If we have a measure of the amplitude of the libration, we have a measure of this guy, the third one, and this we know from C22. And so if we combine observation and multiply these three factors together, and we get Cm, so the polar moment, the moment of inertia of the mantle alone, over the moment of inertia of the whole planet below one, that would mean that Mercury has a fluid core. Okay, so that was a kind of a thought experiment, but this has been tried. And actually, remarkably, it works. So the idea here is you can get measurements of the rotation of the planet by shooting radar on Mercury. So the way it works is you shoot a radar, and then Mercury's topography acts and creates kind of a speckled pattern in return, so a bit like, you know, a disco ball. And so if the disco ball rotates, these speckled patterns here will make a coherent motion. And so if you have two observation stations which receives the beam back, like so here, a place in California and in Maryland, and they're well aligned in the path of these beams, then not only you can measure the spin rate of the planet, but you can measure the obliquity, the direction of the rotation axis. Okay? So you can get the measure of the obliquity and the libration. Remarkably, this works. It's a fantastic experiment, but it does work. Okay, so here's a picture of essentially the red line here represents a model prediction of the libration, and the dots represents measurements. And so the fit is really good. It's actually better to see it here, where all the measurements have been collapsed into kind of one orbital motion. And so the fit is really good. But the key here is that the fit is good as long as it's only the mantle shell that librates. If it was the whole planet, the amplitude, the prediction for the libration amplitude would be twice as small. Okay? So that is really a very good indication that Mercury has a fluid core. Okay? And so then you can actually sort of plug in the numbers. And if you do so, we do get a value of C over mR squared from the obliquity. We do get a value of this quantity from the libration. And so if you combine all these quantities together, you calculate Cm over C, you get this number, which is smaller than 1. So yes, Mercury has a fluid core. But moreover, we also get two predictions, two constraints on the moments of inertia. Okay, so we can use those to build models of the interior. Or essentially, we can build models of the interior and ask whether our models satisfy these constraints. So this has been done by various people. And so, you know, you can build model of the interior structure, of the density, temperature, and so on. And then you can calculate these numbers and see if it matches the observations. Okay, and if it does, it means it's a successful model. So here's a study that did that. It's a recent study. The idea here, what we're looking at, these are all individual dots. They represent a model that matches the mass of Mercury and the radius of Mercury. But then from this model, we calculate the quantities C over mR squared and Cm over C, and then we plot it to where it falls. And the color represents different quantities. So here, it's the core mantle boundary radius. So we see that in order to match observations, Mercury's core needs to be about 2,000 kilometers, okay, 80% of the planetary radius. But here was the surprise with this study, is that if you look at sort of the average mental density, well, you need something quite high, sort of on the order of like 3,700 and something. And then there was a speculation that perhaps this meant that, well, there's kind of a layer of, you know, iron sulfide at the bottom of the mantle. But these measurements have been redone recently, and now we get new values, and if you use the new values, which correspond now to the location of these red crosses, the core mantle boundary location hasn't changed much, but then the mantle density now is about 3,300, which is exactly what we expect for typical silicate mantle density, just like the Earth, okay? So we don't need anything strange. I mean, you know, a high density is still allowable by the data, but we don't need it. Okay, so far what we've done is we've used the rotation and gravity observations to get constraints, get these numbers, okay? But the question that we now want to ask is like, what is the effect of the inner core in this story? And then can we actually, from these numbers, determine between which solidification of the inner core regime that we have? Do we have sort of a growth of the inner core just like the Earth, or are we more in a scenario like sort of an accumulation of snow? Okay? And these things are important for dynamo mechanism, but also just the thermal history of the planet and to understand the nature and concentration of the light element in the fluid core, which has bearing on planetary formation and so on. Okay, so what I've done here with my colleagues is we've built a bunch of interior models where, you know, and I don't want to spend too much time on the details of how we've done this, but we've also incorporated in all these models a thermal stratified layer, so we force the temperature to deviate from the adiabatic temperature gradient, okay, near the top of the core. We've used sulfur as the light element constituent just because we do have data on it, so we can calculate an equation of state. So let's first look at different models as a function of model parameters. So I have three free parameters in my model. I can choose the mantle density, I can choose the amount of sulfur fraction I have near the inner core boundary, and I can choose the inner core radius, okay? So here's a model where, here we go. First, a model where we have relatively small inner core, mantle density of 3,300, and a small amount of sulfur, okay? And so in this case, I create a model where I match the temperature at the inner core boundary to be equal to the melting temperature. And the red curve here represents the adiabatic temperature in the core, and everywhere it's above the melting curve or the liquidus curve, okay? And then we have this stratification here. So this is more sort of a kind of traditional Earth core-like scenario of inner core growth proceeding and, you know, no regions of snow anywhere on the planet, okay? But as you increase the amount of sulfur, then you reach these different regimes, okay? This is not sort of an evolution scenario. This is just kind of using different values and looking at a snapshot different possibility of the convection regime for different values, okay? So as we're going to reduce the sulfur, you're going to see the density drop and the core mantle boundary move further away. That's just, you know, required to satisfy the constraint on the mass of the planet. So here we go. And now what we also see is that close to the inner core boundary, we're still above the melting temperature, but here we have a region where the two are equal. So this is a snow zone. And here we still have a thermal stratification. And then if we keep decreasing the amount of sulfur, or increasing the amount of sulfur, then we get into a regime of deep snow, where we, you know, everywhere in this region we do have snow falling. We still maintain a small layer of thermal stratification. And eventually, if we keep increasing this, then we get into a state where it's snow everywhere. And in this case, we do have, you know, so the temperature is equal to the melting temperature everywhere. So this is, you know, we will have snow falling everywhere in the core. But in this case, there's also an adjustment of the sulfur fraction, which is 10% near the inner core boundary, but then grows to be about 17 or 18% near the core mantle boundary. Okay? But in all of these models, okay, these are just kind of changing these numbers here, we produce a density structure, so we can calculate Cm over C and C over mr squared, so we can play the same game, placing all of these models onto these two axes and see which ones match the constraints that we have from rotation and gravity. Okay, so here's a first example where we use an inner core of 50 kilometers, okay? All of these dots represent an individual model. In this case, the color I'm looking, the color represents sulfur fraction at the inner core boundary, so blue is low and red is high. And I also distinguish the models, sort of the regime of convection that the models are. So the squares are represents regime that are kind of Earth core-like, so no snow. And then when you get into the triangles, that's a snow layer, a snow zone. The circle with the black outline represent deep snow, so snow going all the way to the inner core boundary, but still with a thermal stratification at the top. And then finally, the circle with no black outline are the models that have deep snow everywhere with no thermal stratification. Okay? So one of the immediate things that you see is that, well, in order to best fit the data on rotation, we seem to be already in a situation where we may still have a stratification, but we may, you know, we're just at the boundary for the case where it's a deep snow regime. Okay? This is for a very small inner core. And you can look at different quantities. This is the mental density, and so the average mental density is the same as the models that I showed before, so about 3,300. And this is the core mental boundary, so the kind of best fit value is about 2,000 kilometers. Okay, so similar to the models that I presented before by in the paper of Smith et al. But now what we're going to do is we're going to increase the inner core boundary radius. Okay, so here's what happens at when the inner core is at 500. So all of these models, the color hasn't changed much. They plot pretty much the same in the same place. The only thing that has changed is the boundaries between these different scenarios have all kind of moved to the top left of the diagram, okay? And if we keep increasing the inner core boundary radius, that's going to proceed further, such that when we're here, the best fit models are all in the deep snow, no stratification regime, okay? So that's for an inner core, which is 1,000 kilometers, essentially half of the full core. All right. So now, in this slide, I'm showing all three quantities that I've showed so far, the core mental boundary radius, the density, and the sulfur fraction. And when you're still at 1,000 kilometers, the mental density that best fit the model and the sulfur fraction, you know, are all about the same. But now we're going to keep increasing the inner core and see what happens. So this is at 1,250, 1,400. So now we see something interesting is that all of these models, as the inner core grows bigger, they move to the left part of the C over mr squared, essentially because we concentrate mass in the middle. And then they move to kind of the upper left part here because C becomes smaller. And so here at this point, you can say that, well, if I take these models, like the best fit, to best fit the moments of inertia constraints, these models still match, but just barely, okay? And you need a huge density in order to do it, okay? And if we keep increasing the inner core radius, then at some point it becomes really difficult to explain the observations, okay? All of these models, and clearly, I mean, here you still match the observations. This is the one sigma bar error, so, you know, that's still a valid model in some ways. I mean, in some ways, models that are on here are kind of falling within the two or three sigma bars, so they could still be acceptable. But you can view this differently. You can also think, well, what if we were able to reduce the error bar on these quantities? Then all of these models would not be a valid representation of the interior structure of Mercury. So I've done this experiment and present it slightly differently on this slide here. So here, what I've done is I've constrained all my models to satisfy specific values of these moments of inertia ratio. And I'm looking as a function of inner core radius, what is the adjustment in core mental boundary radius or mental density in order to match the not only these two constraints, but also the mass of Mercury, okay? And so with an inner core being 1,400, you need a very large density and you need an increase in core mantle boundary radius. Now, why can't we continue? Well, the reason we can continue is because of this stub diagram here. So here I'm showing what the sulfur fraction does in order to satisfy these constraints. And so the blue line represents the sulfur fraction at the inner core boundary, the red line at the core mantle boundary, and the dashed lines is the value of the eutectic point. This is the point below, you know, if you drop the temperature below that point, then you don't solidify iron anymore, you solidify a mixture of iron sulfur, which has the same density as the liquid. Okay, so you lose the buoyancy and everything will just freeze. So clearly we're not in that scenario because we have a magnetic field. Okay, so that kind of provides an upper bound for the radius of the inner core. If in the scenario that we have kind of, we don't consider error bars. If we consider error bars, then we can go as high as this, but nevertheless, we do have a limit on the size of the inner core based on these constraints. Okay, what else can we say? We can say a few more things from our results. And I have this slide and then just a couple more slides. Okay, so if, and of course, all of these results are dependent on the fact that I've chosen sulfur as my light element in the core. If you choose a different element, the numbers may be different, and some of these conclusions may not be as valid. But if we do accept that, then it's more likely that convection in Mercury's core involve some snow, okay? And perhaps extending all the way to the inner core boundary, all right? In the scenario that we've looked at, you know, more of models, as soon as you start having an inner core of a sizable radius, then most models fell into that scenario, at least the models that could explain the constraints on rotation. And again, thermal stratification, I only saw that for models that have a relatively small inner core. As soon as the inner core becomes big enough, I don't get that. And then we have that constraint on the size of the inner core. So what are the implications for this on Mercury's dynamo? Well, here's my favorite model, and sorry, Sabine, it's not one of yours, but don't get crushed. Because actually, it's my favorite model, but we'll see that it's not the full answer. Okay, so this is the idea of the thermal stratification at the top of the core. And so that does a couple of things that are very good. It screens all the small timescale variations and the small length scale variations of a complex dynamo inside the planet here, such that near the surface, we only see the large scale effect, okay? And you can get fields of the right order of magnitude. On top of that, this type of convection also generates a pattern of thermal winds, which do act to kind of average out and smear out all these effects such that you tend to get fields that are more or less axisymmetric at the surface. And in this particular case, they also do get kind of a shifted dipole axis, so that also works. So it seems that, you can explain everything with that type of model. Okay, but for this to work, you need a relatively thick thermal layer, and we saw that, I could only get that for very small inner core. You need a generally small inner core, so that was okay with my models. But you also need a deep, vigorous convection deep inside the core. Okay. So just to quickly show again, this is a case for 500 kilometers. Okay, so a relatively small inner core, and again here the best fit models. I do get a lot of models here that are in this stratification regime, so I do have a stratified layer, but they're just close to the boundary, so it's a thin stratified layer, okay? If, you take models that are in this region, then I think that provides a better explanation for a deep stratified top of the core layer. But, that if you keep increasing the inner core here, you'll get into sort of the deep snow, no stratification regime pretty fast. Okay. Now, the one last thing I want to comment on is the idea that if you do have thermal stratification and you have underneath a release of light element, these light elements can still penetrate through the thermal stratification. Okay, so even though thermally things are stable against convection, the fact that you have light buoyant material can still penetrate through. That's called double diffusive convection. And you know, the group of people that I've looked at the thermally stratified dynamos, I've kind of incorporated this in the top region of their dynamo model and looked at that effect on the dynamo, and it created a structure which was completely different. Okay, so you know, this is a numerical simulation. It may well be that in the parameter regime that they looked at, sort of the size of the fingering convection that they got was big enough that this could have an effect on the magnetic field. Maybe in reality, this would be small scale enough that it wouldn't affect the magnetic field signature. Maybe. But the other thing too is that you know, in the models that I've looked at, it's more likely that we have kind of this snow scenario very deep in the core. Okay. Where we're going to have sort of a stratification in terms of the sulfur concentration. So that's also, in some ways, you know, a situation where if you have a release of buoyant light sulfur material that needs to go through, it will penetrate this somewhat stable chemical layer, but by diffusive, double diffusive convection. And whether that can, again, reproduce the observation that we see for the magnetic field of Mercury, to me, that's still a question that needs to be answered. Okay? So I'm just going to finish with this slide here. So essentially here, I've just played a game of trying to constrain the interior structure of the planet and the convection regime of the planet using information from gravity and rotation. And whether, you know, that can be useful in terms of understanding features such as the magnetic field of Mercury, well, the future will have to tell me. But I'll stop here and be happy to answer some questions.